assumed that that was true until I read my Bible. And that's the whole point, right? You can be really comfortable thinking what you think as long as you don't read your Bible, you'll never know any better. But when you start reading your Bible, you take the risk of discovering maybe you're wrong. And that was the whole point of the way we started the morning, right? Do you have an openness to say, maybe what I've always thought isn't right? And it takes an enormous amount of humility to be able to say that. I think I was wrong. I think I need to do something differently. Okay, I don't know where I am in this, so I'm going to jump ahead here just a little bit. I don't want to do all of those questions. Okay, here we go. If a text is a narrative, one of the things about recognizing genre, and genre is simply a style of literature, okay? The major genres are narrative, poetry, and epistles, that kind of thing. I mean, the big, sweeping kind of pictures. But there's lots of subgenres, smaller genres in Scripture. Every genre has a different set of rules. I mean, an added set of rules, okay? You don't interpret poetry the way you interpret prose. That's fairly common sense to most of us. So one of the things about recognizing genre is it slows me down. It forces me to stop and say, okay, what kind of literature is this? What are the rules that apply to this particular kind of literature? This is a doxology. Well, if it's a doxology, what does that mean? How does that affect the way I understand it? Well, narrative is the biggest one, right? Probably more narrative than any other single thing in all of the Bible. It's stories. It's just what it is. It's stories. And if it's stories, then you obviously want to look for the setting. What's the setting? What's going on in this story? And then you want to look for characters. Who are the characters and what are they like? Typically, there are protagonists and antagonists, and then there's just extras on the set. Some characters are very round, meaning that they have lots of information, or at least enough information to really have an idea of who they are. Some are kind of like a one-trick pony. They've got not much to add, you know? And then you're asking yourself about plot. How does the story move? And almost every story moves the same way. It starts out with some basic information, and then somebody does something that kind of makes a twist in the tale. And you get this kind of crisis going on, and then you go through the crisis till it gets resolved. And then after the resolution, it kind of comes out the other side. That's jazz music, by the way. It's also typical movies. That's stories. All right, so let's look at a narrative. I'm trying to decide which narrative to look at because there's so many of them that are just so much fun to look at. Okay, Genesis chapter 12, because it illustrates more things, and then I'm going to quickly show you another one just because I think it's important to see something. In Genesis chapter 12, we have this really fascinating, well, actually, in Genesis chapter 11, remember what I said about narrators? Narrators are omniscient. Narrators know everything. So you're always watching to see what the narrator says. Because he's going to stick stuff in just for your benefit. So back in Genesis chapter 11, verse 30, it says, "Now Sarai was barren, she had no children." Well, that's kind of an odd line to throw in there, you know? But it becomes really important, really quick. Because when you get to Genesis chapter 12, you have this great promise. "I'm going to make you a great nation." Well, how are you going to make a guy a great nation if he has no kids? Now, we don't know about the kids' promises until later, okay? And then later on, it's going to fulfill, I mean, he's going to kind of fill out what this promise looks like by saying, well, your kids are going to be as numerous as the sand on the sea, going to be as stars in the sky. By the way, everything never means everything, always never means always. As many children as the sand in the sea does not mean as many children as sand in the sea. Okay, just saying, don't take everything literally because it isn't literal. There are like a gazillion, million, gazillion stars and Abraham didn't have that many kids. Okay, all the history and the people, the people in the history of the world don't add up to the same number as stars and they didn't all come from Abraham. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we got this promise. Gonna make his name great, yada, 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 yada. So Abram takes his family and he sets off to do whatever he's supposed to do. And you come over here to the chapter 12, verse 10. There was a famine in the land. There you go. Crisis. Got a problem. Conflict. Something's going on. Abram's been sent to this land, and everything's going along fine, and then all of a sudden there's a famine in the land. All right, so we got a famine in the land. Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. And as he was about to enter Egypt, he said, when you're reading a narrative, you want to always pay attention to the dialogue. The dialogue is going to tell you important things. So here's what he says to his wife Sarai. I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister, so that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you. He is such a gentleman. Chivalrous to the hilt. I mean, this is a man's man. I'm going to hide behind my wife and let you take the fall for this because I don't want to die. Now remember, you're a reader. You do not know that he's actually telling a half-truth here. Mm. But you don't know that yet. That'll show up later in the story. Not that it makes any difference, but you don't know that yet. So, when Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that, funny thing, they saw that she was a beautiful woman. She must have been. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. He treated Abram well for her sake, and Abram acquired sheep and cattle and male and female donkeys and men servants and maid servants, and pretty good trade. Do you hear the implications of this? I don't know how many times I have been over this story with people, and they read this story like there's no, you know, okay. She's not coming back. Mm-hmm. This isn't like he had her over for dinner so he could have a nice conversation with her. She's not going back. She's become a part of his harem. She's going to become his wife. This is not a little thing. This is a big deal. In fact, it's so big that verse 17 says, but the Lord afflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife Sarai. And so Pharaoh summoned Abram. What have you done to me? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister so I took her to be my wife? Now then, here's your wife. Take her and go. Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men. They sent him on his way with his wife and everything he had. And so Abram went from Egypt to the Negev with his wife and everything they had. And Lot went with him, and he became very wealthy in livestock and in silver and gold. So listen, if you got a wealthy wife, if you got a beautiful wife, just turn her in for wealth. It works every time. Now, do you see the storyline? Abram's doing fine, and then there's a conflict. There's a problem. There's this issue of famine, and so he goes down to Egypt, and there's this crisis because Pharaoh takes Sarai, and then there's a resolution to the crisis because God steps in and fixes this problem, and then when they leave, everything is kind of back. In fact, it's back a little better than it was before they left. All right, so of all the things that you could say about this text, it would be really nice not to miss the point. The point is not that Abram is a liar. Now, he is. You probably ought not do that. Somebody asked me this week, have you actually heard it preached this way? Yes. I have heard sermons that say, in spite of the fact that Abraham was an absolute jerk and did something really stupid, God blessed him and made him prosperous. Therefore, don't worry about being stupid because God will make you prosperous. It's like, oh, gracious sakes alive. Could we just go back and read our Bibles again, please? Just once. What's the point of the story? And God sent a plague on Pharaoh. Why? Because of Sarai. Why? Because the promise is that Abram is going to be a great nation, and he cannot be a great nation without Sarai. The promise of a new covenant is started right here in Genesis chapter 12, and 10 verses later, 15 verses later, the covenant deal is broken. If this happens, God's entire plan is done. Kaput. So what's the point of the text? God will never let anything interfere with the covenant. And God will not let anything stop him from accomplishing his purposes. He's going to do whatever it takes to make sure that his plan to redeem broken humanity gets carried out, even if he has to override people. This is not about Abram. It's not about Sarah. It's about God. And that's the point. Every story, every narrative, there is one primary character always in the background, and that's God. This is never about Abram, never about Sarah, not ultimately. It's always ultimately about God and his place and what's going on here. And that will help us in our teaching and preaching from getting lost in the weeds and trying to come up with points that, frankly, are just, they're allegorical or spiritual at best. They're certainly not the point. Now, I've often asked this question, who's the primary character in this text? And I guarantee you, if I hadn't already told you it was God, somebody in here would have said Abram. Well, that's because Abram's so important to the Old Testament. But even in the text outside of God, he's not the most important character. Sarah is. She's mentioned more often than Abram is. And if you follow this text, there is a narrative. They lived in the Negev, and they went to Egypt. Then there's a dialogue. You're my sister. Tell him this lie. Then there is a narrative, and that narrative is that God intervened and took care of Sarai. And then there's another dialogue. Why didn't you tell me she was your sister? Then there's another narrative, and they left and went back to the Negev, a wealthy person. So it's narrative, dialogue, narrative, dialogue, narrative. And the middle narrative is out here on the point, and the point of the narrative is this: God intervened. Now, let me show you one other narrative. I mean, there's narratives absolutely everywhere. Let's just look at one other one because it's kind of fun. Go over to Samuel. Samuel tells us all about David. And, of course, everybody loves David. David is everybody's favorite character. So 2 Samuel chapter 11. 2 Samuel chapter 11. Now, remember, the point of narrative is that you're going to have a setting, you're going to have characters, you're going to have plot. All right, so here's the setting. Narrator sets you up right from the very beginning. He gives you the perspective through which you should read the story. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, okay, there's your setting. It's spring. That's when kings go off to war. Now, unless you're Donald Trump, you go off to war anytime you want. But in the biblical day, it was spring, and that's when kings go to battle, because you can't fight during the winter, and it's too hot during this, anyway. David sent Joab with the king's men and his whole Israelite army, and they destroyed the Ammonites, and they besieged Reba. But, remember the connecting words? Mm-hmm. But, David stayed in Jerusalem. Huh. Funny thing, it's spring when kings go off to war, but David didn't go off to war. David stayed in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and he walked around on the roof of his palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" And then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him. He slept with her. Then there's a parenthesis. She had purified herself from her uncleanness. And then she went back home, and the woman conceived and sent word to David saying, "I am pregnant." You know how this story moves. And then David sent for Uriah in hopes that he would come home and sleep with his wife, and he could blame the pregnancy off on Uriah. Except Uriah came home and slept in the doorway of the palace. And when David said, "Why did you do that?" There is so much irony in this statement. The king's men are in war. Why would I come home and sleep with my wife, David? Why would you not be to war? That's where kings are supposed to be. So David said, "Well, stick around a while longer." And he got him drunk. And he sent him home. And he wouldn't go home. He slept in the doorway again. One commentator said, Uriah was a better man drunk than David was sober. Which I think is probably true. And of course, that didn't work. He didn't sleep with his wife. Can't blame him. So he sends him off into war with a letter, and he gets sent to the front, and he gets killed. There are a lot of things I want you to notice about this, but I want you to notice the last verse of chapter 11 first. David tries to come off a hero in this story. So after Uriah dies, and there's a time of mourning, he says, oh, I will bring sweet Bathsheba in. I'll take care of her because I'm such a good man. But the thing David had done displeased the Lord. That's not even a great translation. But the thing David did was evil. Is what that text says. It was evil. See, some texts interpret themselves. You don't even have to worry about it. It just tells you right up front. What is the conclusion of this? What he did was evil. Now, I'm going to give you several things here. I'm just part of the reading narrative. I'm going to tell you one of the things that has frustrated me more than any other single thing. And that is when I have come to Eastern, and it's more true in Eastern Europe than anybody. I'm sorry, you're the guilty parties. It has come to Eastern Europe more than any other single place. People want to blame Bathsheba. She should have said no. You understand anything about culture? This is Israel. Women don't matter. This is 1,000 years before Jesus, and they didn't matter in Jesus' day, and they certainly didn't matter 1,000 years before that. They were absolutely powerless people. This is the king. You don't say no to the king. Come on. And yet I really think it's because we have so much respect for King David. I mean, after all, it's King David. And the Messiah comes through David. And we know that David was a man after God's own heart, so David couldn't be at fault. Bathsheba should not have been on the roof taking a bath. Well, where else was she going to take one? That's where bathtubs were. These are flat-roofed homes, remember? This is the Middle East. They put a bucket of water up there, a big bucket, in order to get warm. And so in the evening, after the day had heated the water, the women went up on the roof and they took, I suppose everybody did, not just the women, but that's where you took your bath. A little background study would do us all good. But I want you to notice several other things about this text. One of the things that stories have is pace, how fast they happen. So far, this is moving really slow. This is the spring. It's the time when kings go off to war. David is up on the roof. He sees this woman on the other side. He sends somebody over to find out how she is. The guy comes back and says it's the daughter of Eli and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And then all of a sudden it says, and David sent for her, took for her scepter. Bam, 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 bam. I mean, verb after verb after verb after verb after verb. The pace quickens. This is not David fell in love with his neighbor's wife. This is nothing more than just compulsion on David's part. He is just exacting his power and doing what he wants. Now, in the middle of that, the narrator throws in a comment. Remember what I said? Narrators know everything. And narrators are always telling you things that matter. Bathsheba had just returned from being purified. After every monthly cycle, a Jewish woman had to go to the temple and have the priest pronounce her clean again. Now, for those of you who are smarter than I was, when I first started using my Bible and had no idea what this meant, here's what it means. She wasn't pregnant. Women don't have menstrual cycles when they're pregnant. She had just had a menstrual cycle. She's not pregnant. This is David's child. That's what the point is. This is David's child. Now, part of what frustrates me about this whole thing is that this is Bathsheba, the wife, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah. You know who Eliam and Uriah are? Here's what I'm going to tell you. I am going to make an assumption here, and if I am wrong, I'm just going to issue a public apology right now for being wrong, because I'm wrong about so many things. But my guess is that you're just like me. You read the story, and you don't worry about who they are. They're just names in the story. It's her dad. It's her husband. Okay. Eliam and Uriah are members of David's private guard. Remember the 30 mighty men? One text says the 33 mighty men of David, they are his private guard. They are the guys that spent time in the cave with him when he was running from King Saul. These are the people that take care of him under all circumstances. They are the like the CIA people that surround your president or whatever. Do you think he didn't know who they were? You really believe that after spending weeks in a cave with the same 30 men, he wouldn't have known who Eliam and Uriah were? And he took her anyway. No wonder, the text says, it was evil. I hate to destroy King David for you, but he's a jerk. Now, he's also the one to whom everybody gets compared. Every king in Israel's history was compared to... He was just like King David, or he wasn't like King David. He shows up in the New Testament as a man after God's own heart. Boy, that gives me a lot of comfort. I could be stupid and still be a man after God's own heart. You might want to read Psalm 52, or 51, Psalm 32. Those are David's repentance. There's something significant about that. The story unfolds so that you begin to see how... All I want you to do is learn how to read narrative. Just look for the details. Just pay attention to what's going on so that you see how the story actually gets lived out. Of course, you know what happens after this. Nathan the prophet shows up and tells him the story about the little sheep and the neighbors. And of course, you know what David says. He says, he just quotes the law. He says, that man ought to pay back four times for the sheep that he stole. Because that's the law of restitution. Guess what? Count them. David had four sons who died. I don't think that's coincidental. Okay, well, narrative. There you go. The text is narrative. You recognize, when I say the three levels, there's a great big level. It's called the overarching meta narrative. It's the story of redemption. Okay? There's another level underneath that. That's the patriarchs, Moses or the law, and the church. They've got kind of three categories, from the beginning up through Moses, Moses up through Jesus, and Jesus to the end. And then the third, the bottom level, is just all the individual stories. And what these particular authors tell us to do is make sure we keep an idea of where we are. And again, that testamental differentiation, is this in the patriarchs? Is this during the law? Is this during the church? That individual story, the way to make sure that you don't miss the point of the story is to ask, how does it contribute to the top story? How does it add to my understanding of the redemptive movement of God? That's the biggest issue that we face. We get caught in weeds and we start making applications that are just not helpful when we stay down at the bottom level. But if we keep everything at the top level, we step back and say, how does this help me understand God, His plan? What will that do for me? Focus on the primary character. That's God, by the way. Avoid spiritualizing, moralizing the story. By the way, there's a lot of sermons out there on, be a David, be a Jonah, be a Micah, be a whatever, Obviously, we picked the good ones, Daniel. And except as they imitate God. The Bible is very honest with characters, okay? That's one of the things I like about Scripture, is that you get the real picture of who these people are. And you don't want to imitate everything about them. That's just the bottom line. You just don't. So I avoid doing the please imitate David thing. Well, there are parts of David's life that I would imitate. There are genuinely things that he did that are legitimately imitatable, if that's a word. But don't just generically say, hey, we all ought to be like Joseph. Well, Joseph's a pretty good character, but be careful with that. They're not the primary issue. All right, well, it's like 10 to 3. I don't know what your plan is, but that's just the first... That's the first literary genre, and there are like seven of them that I don't have time to go through. Can I have 9 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Yeah. Let me skip the legal stuff, because I've already said some stuff about the legal stuff. The legal stuff is not directly applicable to us. We learn the principles behind the law. Like Jesus said, thou shalt not commit adultery, but you've heard thou shalt not commit adultery, but I say to you, don't even lust after a woman. So he even makes the law more restrictive anyway. Here's what I want to say just something about prophetic literature, because I think that's one of the most troublesome ones that we face. And I rarely end the day on prophetic literature, because it's usually the place I get myself in the most trouble. And I kind of like to start the day when there's lots of time to fix the trouble or make it worse, as the case may be. Please recognize that all prophetic literature is in a literary and a historical context. And you've got to understand the context to be able to make sense out of it. So, for example, I was going to tell you this anyway. One of the things that we do at our church is, have done now, this is the third year in a row that we've done it, is that during the fall, starting in September, we do what we call an all-church study. So all of our small groups, junior high, high school, adult, Sunday morning, midweek, everybody is doing the same lesson, and it's based on the text that's preached on Sunday morning. And we, like the first year we did 1 Timothy, this last year we did Colossians, this year we're doing the book of Micah. So, which is really kind of fun. I've been reading this sermon that's going to get preached tomorrow. This poor guy, he's one of our elders, I really feel bad for him. He gets the first two chapters of Micah, because there's only two verses in the second chapter that are not a part of his sermon. And it's all negative. It's really, really harsh stuff. I've been reading this sermon and thinking, man, you're doing a good job with that. I'm glad you have that sermon and not me. Every prophet starts, and here's Micah. The word of the Lord that came to Micah of Moresheth during the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. All right, so there you go. There's your historical setting. Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So what are you going to do? You're going to go back to the kings and to the chronicles, and you're going to read about those kings, and you're going to make a list of the conditions. Were they? And was this a time of war? Was this the time when Israel was doing well? Was this a time of high idolatry? In Micah's time, it started out a time of high idolatry, but Hezekiah comes along and he's a reformer, and so he's reforming this. This happens to be Micah prophesies during these three kings. Well, these three kings are the kings that are in place when Sennacherib comes and destroys Assyria. Assyria comes and destroys the northern tribes. It's also just before the Babylonian captivity. So you're looking for those historical references as you read, because that's what he's talking about, right? All right, so you're going to remember that the prophets do these three things. And this is where I usually get in trouble, and it takes a lot of explanation. So let me do this quickly. The primary purpose of a prophet is to prosecute Israel, because they're making a mess out of the covenant. So you have things like this that show up in the early parts of Micah. Look, the Lord is coming out of his dwelling place. He comes down and he treads the high places of the earth. The mountains melt between beneath him. The valleys split apart. They like wax. All of this because of Jacob's transgression, because of the sins of the house of Israel. Therefore, I will make Samaria a heap of rubble, a place of planting. I mean, it's just harsh. It's direct. It's confrontation. And they prosecute. In fact, we actually call some of these things lawsuit oracles, because he's taking them to court. The other thing we call them, and they're different, but there are several different kinds of oracles. One of them is called a woe oracle. That by itself ought to tell you what it's about. It's a woe oracle. Not woe as in a horse. Woe as in alas. And the reason they call it a woe oracle is because the very first word in the text is waveh. Woe. Oh no. This is a problem. Most of the prophets are prosecution. Some people would call it proclamation. What they're doing is they're speaking into the life of Israel based on what they know about God, based on what they know about the law. They are now speaking to Israel and saying, hey, you're a mess. Makes preaching prophets hard, by the way. The second thing they do is try to persuade. Come back. Return. Come to me. Please hear that. Are you hearing this? Come to me. Return to me. Now, here's the one that everybody likes. They predict. You would think, talking to most of the people that I talk to all over the world, that the most important thing a prophet does is predict the future. It's not true. Less than 5% of all prophetic literature is predictive. And most of the less than 5% prophecy that is predictive is what we read this morning in Jeremiah 29. In 70 years, this is going to happen to you, and you're going to be there for 70 years, but after 70 years, you're going to come home. That's the predictive nature of the Old Testament prophet. You're about to get destroyed. This is what's going to happen. That's the nature of prediction. There's about this much that might not yet have been fulfilled. Maybe. Okay, I already know I'm in trouble because I've been to Poland before. What I want you to hear is what we typically do with prophecy is we use it to prove that our Bibles are true. See, the Bible says this would happen. See, it happened. Therefore, the Bible is true. That's not why prophecy is given in the first place. Even if it is predictive, that's not why it's done to prove the Bible. There wasn't a Bible. To be really honest between you and me, I don't think God cares whether you think the Bible is true or not. I don't think that's of any concern to him at all. And I'm pretty sure he could care less whether or not you go out on the street corner and convince people the Bible is true. Did you know, well, you do, but let me say it as a rhetorical question. Did you know that if you believe the Bible is true, that will not get you to heaven? Can you tell that I'm not really keen on a lot of apologetics, which is aimed at proving the Bible's truth? Because being convinced that the Bible is true is not redemptive. I'm going to show you more about that in just a second, if you'll stay with me. I've used up 8 of my 9 minutes. I'm not going to do it in 9 minutes. All right, so you got to identify the subgenre. So there are like parables and riddles and other kinds of things in prophetic literature. By the way, what kind of literature is the dominant kind of literature in prophetic literature? It's poetry. Almost all prophecy is poetic. It's written in poetic language, which means that there is lots and lots of figurative language. They are not literal. Can I say that one more time? They are not literal. Can I repeat that again? They are not literal. They're figurative. And figurative language doesn't make it less real. It doesn't mean it's not saying something of great significance. Yeah. It just isn't literal. So let me read just a piece of Micah for you. He says, I'm going to make Samaria, by the way, not the country of Samaria, but the city of Samaria, which was the capital of the northern kingdom. I'm going to make Samaria a heap of rubble, a place for planting vineyards. I will pour her stones into the valleys and lay bare her foundations. All of her idols will be broken into pieces. All her temple gifts will be burned with fire. I will destroy all of her images because she has gathered her gifts from the wages of the prostitutes, and the wages of the prostitutes they will be again used. Well, no, that not all of that happened. But it's a figure of destruction, of desolation, of being destroyed. Almost always what you get in prophetic literature is the same set of figures. The land, the temple, and prosperity, or absolute and total destruction. Like this will, there'll never be another person. In the Babylonian captivity language in Jeremiah, Isaiah, Micah, it says these cities will be destroyed and nobody will ever inhabit them again forever and ever and ever. The problem is they are now inhabited. So either the Bible's wrong or we're wrong in the way we read the language. It's hyperbole. It's figures of speech. We call them stock images. Those of you who work in media know what stock images are. They're just standard images that you use to communicate the same thing again next time. If you need a beautiful mountain, you just grab a beautiful mountain because a beautiful mountain indicates something that you want to indicate. Mm-hmm. You don't have to get the specific mountain, you just get the general mountain because it's beautiful. The Bible is full of stock images, and if you pay attention, you'll see the same thing over and over again. Come back to the land, going to destroy the land. Going to have lots of crops, not going to have any crops. You're going to have lots of kids, you're not going to have any kids. We're going to have a temple, we're not going to have a temple. Because those communicate the same thing over and over again. The power of God's presence or the power of God's destruction. So remember that it's poetic. Ask yourself about the New Testament. Does the New Testament say anything about this? Does it use this prophecy in some way? Here's where I'm going to jump into this. I'm going to just beg you for another couple of minutes, which is a lie. It's not going to be 2 minutes. Come over to chapter 5. This is outside of Micah 6:6, that God is desiring justice and mercy and humility. This is probably the most famous Micah text. Chapter 5, verse 2. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. Therefore Israel will be abandoned until the time when she who is in labor gives birth and the rest of the brothers return to join the Israelites. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord and in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. They will have security. They will live securely for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth and he will be their peace. Now where in the world does that show up? Well, of course, in the birth narratives of Jesus in Matthew. A greatly abbreviated version of this shows up in Matthew. So look at Matthew. Look at Matthew chapter 2, where this shows up. This is just one of a couple of illustrations of this that I think is really significant. So in Matthew chapter 2, the Magi show up. They've been chasing this star down. They come to King Herod, and he wants to know listen to this very carefully. He wants to know where the Christ is to be born. The Christ is not Jesus' name. The Christ is the Messiah. Okay? This really is significant. In Bethlehem of Judea, they replied, for the prophet has written. Okay, there you go. We've now set up the Micah prophecy, if that's what it is. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. Well, first of all, that's like 180 degrees opposite of what he said. What he said in Micah was, you're just kind of a puny little town, and you don't amount to much. In Matthew, he says, but you're by no means least in the cities of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who shall be the shepherd of my people Israel. Okay, so out of you is going to come the Messiah, the shepherd. That's the Messiah language, the shepherd language. You notice he never mentions that Jesus is going to be born there. It's the Messiah who will be born there. Micah chapter 5 is not a prediction of Jesus. It's a prediction of Messiah. Now hang on, stay with me, don't give up. One of the things that means is there had to be something that happened in the day of Micah that actually was what he was talking about. It had to mean something to those first readers. Mm-hmm. And what happened to those first readers was there actually was a king that was born who came and brought Israel back. Okay? It's the same thing. Don't get totally distracted here because I'm not done. Isaiah chapter 7. There'll be a son born to a young woman, and you'll call his name Emmanuel, and no da 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 da. And everybody jumps immediately to the New Testament and says, that's about Jesus. No, it's not. It's about the next king to be born in Israel. It had to be, because it had to mean something to the people who read it. People in Israel, 600 years before Jesus, were not thinking about Jesus coming 600 years later because they didn't know anything about it. They were waiting for the next person to be born. His name was Maher Shalal Hashbaz. And he fulfilled the prophecy that was given in Isaiah's day. Hang on to that. I want to show you something in John chapter 7. And this is why I usually don't ever get invited back, because people just look angry at me for saying stuff like this. In John chapter 7, verse 25, at that point, some of the people of Jerusalem began to ask, isn't this the man that they are trying to kill? They're talking about Jesus, obviously. Here he is, speaking publicly, and they're not saying a word to him. Have the authorities really concluded that he is the Christ? The whole question about Jesus was this question. Is he really the Christ? Is it possible that this man that we know as the carpenter's son is really the Messiah that was promised? We know where this man is from. When the Christ comes, no one will know where he is from. And then Jesus, still teaching in the temple court, said, yada, 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 yada. Here's what I want you to hear. And I think this is such a significant issue. When Matthew looks back at Micah chapter 5, he doesn't say that was a prediction of the birth of Jesus. He says that was a conversation about the birth of the king, the Messiah, the messianic person in Israel back in those days, the man who was going to bring peace to the nation. Oh, he says, by the way, Jesus looks a lot like that. He must be the Messiah. Do you hear the difference? The apologist wants to make this all predictive. Why, look, 600 years before Jesus came, it was predicted that he would show up. There were lots of people born in Bethlehem. Tons of people born in Bethlehem. But only one of them was the Messiah. And it wasn't that the Old Testament prophet was about Jesus. It was about the Messiah. And when Israelites looked at Jesus and said, oh, he might be the Messiah, hey, guess what? He's from Bethlehem. They said that the Messiah would come from Bethlehem. He might be him. I know that sounds like I find myself feeling, man, I feel like I'm just barking up a tree and nobody's paying any attention to me. It's not that I don't think God has the ability to predict the future. Don't even think that. God can do anything he jolly well pleases. But I don't think that he had prediction in mind back then. He knew that. He was aware. But Micah didn't know that. Micah wasn't aware of that. All over Matthew particularly, you have these fulfillments. That's the word that Matthew uses. That this word has been made complete. That's what the word fulfilled means. It's been made complete. It's been made whole. And he says this. He says, hey, out of Egypt I've called my son. That's a Hosea prophecy. Hosea wasn't thinking about Jesus. Hosea was looking at the history of Israel. It's a historic statement. Hosea said, God called Israel out of Egypt. But Matthew says, hey, that's the same thing that happened back then, and now it's happening again with Jesus. All right, so when I take that Old Testament prophecy stuff, I think, okay, I'm not thinking prediction. I'm thinking creating an image of what might be, and then I look at the image and say, well, that's it. It matches that. Then I move into the New Testament, and I say, hey, maybe the book of Revelation is not trying to predict the events in the future. Maybe what the book of Revelation is doing is saying, these are the kinds of things that will happen. And when you see them, you'll recognize them because it's the same kind of thing that's happening now. And it will look familiar. The technical term is, there's a type and an anti-type. There's an image, and then there's a reflection of that image. I just think that will keep us out of a lot of difficulties. And here's why. Because I'm going to pull two or three pieces together. I'm going to make this as complicated as I know how, and I'm going to quit. We have a significant number of people in the world, and Eastern Europeans are among them, as much as anybody I've ever met, who want to take all of the prophetic stuff about Israel literally. like there's going to be a return to the land. Israel's going to set up a nation. They're going to get Jerusalem back. They're going to rebuild the temple. They're going to reinstitute sacrifice. And then we'll know that things are about to end. Well, first of all, I have a question. Why? Did Jesus not die? Does not the book of Hebrews make it absolutely abundantly clear that the death of Jesus satisfied all other sacrifices and we don't need him anymore? He died once for all for everybody. Why would we reinstate sacrifice when Jesus has already done it? And oh, by the way, what's the temple represent? The presence of God. What did Jesus say?
Yeah.
If you want to see God? Well, then what did he say? Well, he actually said it through the apostles. Who represents the presence of God today? I'm looking at him. You, he said, are the temple. You are the living presence of God. Why would he want to go when he has presence all over the world? Why would he want to relocate his presence in one simple location like Jerusalem? And then everybody says, well, just read Ezekiel. I have. And for chapter after chapter after chapter, it describes this absolutely perfect temple. And they say, well, that's literal. And I say, no, it's not. It's a picture of the presence of God. The absolute perfect presence of God. Why would God need a building? In fact, when you get to heaven, when heaven gets to us in Revelation 21 and 22, we don't need a temple because God's there. His presence is already there. So when we start making everything literal, then we hear him say things like this, we're going to go back to the land. And I go, wait a minute, maybe he's not saying literally we're going to go back to the land. Maybe he's saying the land represents the gift and generosity and presence of God because it's a stock image of his presence and his graciousness. And what we're going to experience is God's gracious presence in our life. Last one and I'm done. Because I got myself in a world of hurt with a bunch of Polish people over this, and I'm just going to keep using this illustration. You did it to me. 1995, I'm teaching a bunch of Polish people at Haus Edelweiss in Austria, and I confess I was sarcastic. I should not have been. It is my nature to just be. My son-in-law is not the only person in the world who's sarcastic. And I did not realize, and this may be true for you, David. Back in 1995, David Regan was incredibly popular in the United States as a prophecy dude, and he was very, very popular over here in Poland. David Regan has taken the text in Isaiah that says, deserts are going to burst into bloom. And he shows a picture of PVC pipe running out through the deserts of Israel, watering plants. And there's these little itty-bitty plants out there that they're nurturing with this watering system. And he says, this is the beginning of the fulfillment of prophecy. There will be a garden here instead of a desert. And I'm going, that doesn't sound like bursting to me. That sounds like farming. Bursting sounds to me like all of a sudden it just kind of pops into existence. Now, if Israel suddenly becomes a garden, I'll apologize for being wrong. But let me tell you what I think happens. When you force a text to be literal, you got to figure out how to make it work. And the way he figured out how to make it work was to say, well, this is obviously the beginning of what's going to become a garden, and that just violates everything about the word bursting completely. But think about it. A desert bursting into bloom. Can you imagine a more massive change than waking up one morning in a desert and the next morning in a lush garden? That is about as good an illustration as I know of massive, unbelievable change. I invite you into my life. A bartender's kid who knew nothing about God, who earned the reputation that you shouldn't let him play with your friends, your children, who is now preaching in Eastern Europe and talking about Jesus and trying to help people understand their Bible. That is bursting into bloom. That's massive change. Now, you can only take my word for it because you didn't know me back then. But I've seen it over and over and over again. Tim came into my office, one of the angriest men I have ever met in my life. I did his father's funeral, and he used to come by my office all the time wanting me to tell him that his dad went to heaven, which I had to say, I can't tell you that because I have no idea. And the day he came into my office, he was so mad. He had taken his new vehicle down to the shop to get the oil changed, and they got this little tiny drop of oil on the seat, and he was, I mean, we're talking livid, furious, angry. I didn't have, he was just ready to hit the wall. I mean, he was going to sue the company. He was going to make them give him a new car. He was just flying off the handle. 2-3 weeks later, he went on a men's outing with some of our guys, and he had the misfortune of being with two of the best men I have ever met in my life. And these guys sat in the rain around the campfire and talked to this boy about Jesus. And within about a month, he'd given his life to Christ. Mm-hmm. And he came back to my office one day, and he's sitting there in my chair, and he said, yeah, he said, I just took my vehicle back down there to get it worked on. And he said, they backed it into the wall and crushed the fender. And I'm ready for it. And he says, yeah, he says, it's just a car. And I thought, desert's just bursted into bloom. That's conversion. That's change. And that fits that picture way better than an irrigation system in the middle of Israel. Because I don't think the prophets were ever intended to be taken literally. They were intended to paint pictures of what could be when God gets a hold of people. So I'm inviting you, when you read your Bible, to remember that figurative language is just that. It's figurative language, and it paints pictures for you. It should never be taken literally. It should be taken for what it is, a figure of speech, a metaphor of some kind. Well, there's like, I don't know, 87 more hours that we could talk about this. You've already given up the bulk of the one day a week that you get off. So I'll quit now, but thank you. I'm delightfully grateful that you've endured this with me today, so thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for the work.